Good morning, everyone. We were speaking the last 2 weeks about how conversion should be according to the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch, and whatnot. And Bruce asked me that today I give a different kind of a shiur and not necessarily talk about what should be, but rather what is. In other words, what happens in a typical Beit Din? How does it work with a convert? And ultimately, to get into some of the political issues of what's happening today. I am not going to talk about politics, per se. I'm going to talk about what the reality is, the factual reality. And of course, you can then decide politically if it's good, if it's bad, if you want to vote for this party or that party, that's your business. I'll tell you the facts, and then you'll have to deal with it. So let's take a step back first and talk about what happens in a typical Beit Din. My answer is I don't know what happens in every Beit Din. I know what happens in the Beit Din I work for, so I'll give you a little bit of a background. There's two kinds of opening files in Beit Dins. One is coming to a Beit Din and say, hi, I'd like to convert. And we learn the Gemara in Yevamos, Daf Mem Zayin, Amud Aleph, into Amud Bet, what the Rambam paskins in Ilchot Isurei Beya, the Shulchan Aruch in Simon Reish, Samech Chet, in Yoredeya. They all basically say when a convert comes to convert, you ultimately have to tell them what Judaism is really about. Not necessarily. The Gemara said explicitly you have to tell them what Judaism is about. You have to tell them there's anti-Semitism. You have to tell them that it's hard to be a Jew. It's not always wonderful daisies and roses. You have to give them the truth. And you have to tell them some of the easy mitzvot and the hard mitzvot, etc. You can't just tell them it's a white tablecloth on Shabbos. You have to also tell them that the Shiva Sabbatam was on the calendar to date. And once that happens, ultimately they start what's called a conversion process. That's one way. You come to a Beit Din, you open a file, they do the procedure, and then they open a file and they tell you what to do. This is what you have to learn, this is what you have to cover, how do you do it? It's up to you. That's one kind of Beit Din that a convert can come to. Yeah?
Well, that sounded more like a Beit Din, Norway, Idaho, Boston,
so
as opposed to in Israel where why tell a person it's hard to be a Jew?
I'll explain. It's not always easy to be a Jew. It's wonderful to be a Jew, but they can't say it's easy to be a Jew. I don't think anyone's going to tell you, and I'm not going to tell you that anyone in Efrat's going to say it's going to be easy when it's 30 degrees. Put this in the to make it very tangible. It's not easy when it's 30 degrees to fast on Tisha B'Av. It's not easy. Is it significant? Yes. Is it an experience? Yes. Is it easy? Absolutely not. Is it easy to keep the laws of family purity? Once again, is it significant? Yes. Is it something that adds to a marriage? I believe so. Is it easy? No, it's not easy. On the other hand, is it easy to get drunk on Purim? If you like whiskey, if you like wine, yes, it's very easy. You have to give them the truth. So the one way of opening up a file is to start the conversion process with a certain Beit Din. They tell you what to do. They give you guidelines, criteria. Now, how do you cover the material? It's up to the Beit Din to decide. That's one kind of Beit Din. There's another kind of Beit Din that says, look, we want to see observant Jews come. We discussed last week that Kabbalat Mitzvot is Ma'akev in conversion. How do we know that? Because the Shulchan Aruch Paskins what? That if a convert went to mikveh without a Beit Din, just two people, b'diyeved, it's okay. If he did Brit Milah with only two people, b'diyeved, it's okay. But if he did Kabbalat Mitzvot, acceptance of Mitzvot, without three people, without a Beit Din, it's not okay, even b'diyeved. So we know Kabbalat Mitzvot is ma'akev. So this Beit Din comes and says, listen, when you come to us polished and ready. How you get there? It's up to your rabbi in your community, it's up to your conversion course, your conversion institution, whatever it might be. Once you come to us, you come polished. So once again, there's two main roads that you can take in a normative Beit Din. One is you open a file and they give you guidelines, they assign you a teacher, they assign you a rabbi, or the opposite. They say, listen, these are our guidelines, how you get there is none of our business. Once you're ready, come to us. We'll give you a test, and we'll talk about that in a moment, and we'll see if you're ready. Yes, Harold.
I just want to know, I think you discussed it, just remember what you said. If he wants to commit, is there any problem in keeping Shabbos while he's in the conversion process?
Harold asked a very, very good question, because Harold remembers a Gemara that says, Goy Sheshavat Chayav Mita. A Goy, a non-Jew, that keeps Shabbos, is liable of death. Very hard Gemara. So according to that, until you become Jewish, you shouldn't keep Shabbos. And indeed, there are batei din, and there are people that deal with conversion in the world, that say that indeed, up until the moment that you go to mikvah, you do milah, and you do kabbalah mitzvot, you become a full-fledged Jew, always on Shabbos, violate Shabbos a little bit. Now what does that mean? And this gets into our next issue. Whether you go to this kind of Beit Din or that kind of Beit Din, you open a file and start through a Beit Din, or you open a file at the end of your process, the bottom line is, we want you to become an observant Jew. Now, how do you become an observant Jew? You need two things. Number one, you need the knowledge. And number two?
Maaseh.
You need the commitment. The Gemara in Kiddushin asks what's more important, and comes to the conclusion at the end of the first parak in Kiddushin that Talmud, namely learning, is more important than Maaseh, because learning will lead to Maaseh. Namely, when you learn about Shabbos, you'll keep Shabbos. When you learn about Tefillin, you keep Tefillin. So you can't expect a convert to come to a conversion, eventually go to mikvah, do the milah, do the tefillah, and then say, okay, I'm ready. Okay, great, put on tefillah. Make the brachos, put on tefillah, say shema, shmones, don't forget korbanos, very important. Psukei dezimra, word for word. How are you supposed to do that? So obviously, during what we call the conversion process, which is the next step after you approach a beis din or you approach a rabbi, you're beginning to learn about mitzvot and to fulfill mitzvot. So I ask Sarah, that's fine. But what about Shabbos? We have this Gemara that says, you know how to keep Shabbos? So indeed, there's two answers. One is, we always tell a convert, okay, do one thing on Shabbos to violate Shabbos. Rip a piece of toilet paper. That's the known joke out there, right? Okay, carry a key in your pocket if there's no eruv. Okay. The other school of thought says that whole Gemara is talking about someone that's keeping Shabbos for the wrong reasons, for sakes of Avodah Zarah or whatever. But if he's keeping Shabbos as a prerequisite or as practice to become a Jew, then it's absolutely 100% fine to do it. Because how do you expect him to keep Shabbos after he becomes a Jew? What, all of a sudden he's going to go from here to there? He's going to regulate himself not to carry a key on Shabbos? That's not something easy. So therefore, the other school of thought says, if you're in a conversion process, then ultimately you can basically begin to keep mitzvot, and perhaps even obligated in the mitzvot that you keep because you're in a conversion process. Now, if you recall, around this table, we gave a shiur about what happens if you're in a conversion process. You didn't do milah, or tevilah, or even kabbalah's mitzvot, but you died in the middle. Are you still a goy? Are you a Jew? What are you? That's a whole nother shiur. I have a lot to say about it. Suffice it to say that I'll say in one sentence, I don't believe you're a non-Jew anymore, but you're not a Jew as of yet. You're somewhere in the middle. So those are the two schools of thought. In general, our Beit Din advises every single convert to keep all the mitzvot as they learn about it. So they learn about Shabbos, keep Shabbos. They learn about kosher, keep kosher, etc. Shabbos is the only issue because that is a machlokas between poskim, but everything else, if you want to keep kosher, it doesn't kill you. A non-Jew can eat kosher food. Nothing's going to happen to him.
Shabbos is the only thing where it's death for a non-Jew to keep.
Again, there is a Gemara like that. The question is, does it relate to someone in a conversion process? But there's no other mitzvah that I know of that it says a non-Jew can't do. Absolutely. So, whether you go to this based in or that based in, the bottom line is you begin to learn about mitzvot and to practice mitzvot. This can take how much? How much time? Depends on the person. If the person's a fast learner, then maybe it will take 6 months. If the person needs more time, they need to kosher its kitchen. They need to move in order to move near a shul, because they're not within walking distance of a shul. It might take more time. Every person has to get to the same level. As to how much time it takes as long as it is for that person. Now, how do we know that they're ready? Eventually, you have a test or a bunch of tests. Either you work through a Beis Din, and as you're going through the process, they meet with you every few months, and they ask you, how are things going? And they give you a little test, and they said, okay, you're good on brachos, brush up on kosher laws, or you're good on kosher laws, brush up on Shabbos. Or, as I said, the other kind of Beis Din is, come to us polished, we'll test you on everything, give you an hour and a half test, and if you're ready, you're ready. Yes?
Does any Beis Din require the potential convert to go to somebody's homes for Shabbat to see how a Shabbat is done, or and then do you pick who it is, because depending on who you're going to.
So here I'm going to get into the more nitty-gritty, and that is, again, I can't talk for any other Beis Din than the one I represent. But the one I represent basically says like this. When you're ready, we're the second kind of Beis Din. When you're ready, approach us. So let's say a month or two before you're ready. First and foremost, we don't accept people off the street. We don't believe that you can be a Jew in this day and age without a community. So if you're living in Hutzplatz, if you're living on a deserted island, if you're Robinson Crusoe and you say, I want to be Jewish, I want to be called Reuven, what's Caruso? No, someone come up with a Jewish name for Caruso, quick. Kahan, okay.
Korowitz.
They'll think he's a Cohen. Korowitz, instead of Robinson Crusoe. We don't believe it's going to last. It's very difficult to be a Robinson Crusoe. We believe you need a community. So the way our Beis Din works is as follows. We only work if the rabbi of your community refers you to the Beit Din. And we require the following. First of all, we require that the rabbi writes a letter of recommendation saying, I know this person for X amount of years. They started here, they got to here, and I believe they're ready for conversion, and I'm putting him before you for your consideration. And again, it's very objective because he's subjective. He knows the couple. Perhaps not only knows the couple, but the parents of the couple are one of his biggest donors, whatever it might be. But he's the rabbi referring. And he refers to an objective based in of three. The objective based in of three not only requires a letter from the rabbi, they also require what we call a Jewish life story from the potential converts and their spouse, their Jewish spouse usually. We talked about this last week, that it could be that your Jewish spouse or your Jewish girlfriend or boyfriend was the one that introduced you to Judaism, but eventually you accepted it upon yourself. You learned the true love of Moshe together. So ultimately, when that happens, we want a letter of what we call a Jewish CV as to the convert, where were you and where are you, and from the Jewish spouse. Because many a times, and this is no secret, an observant Jew usually doesn't fall in love with a non-Jew. So how did this Jew become an observant Jew? Through the conversion process. We want to see that in writing. So we ask for a Jewish life story from the Jewish spouse, from the convert-to-be, and the rabbi recommending. And beyond every other piece of paperwork, such as passport pictures, etc., that's what we ask for to start. Now, Harold said something that we also require, and that is that there are families that recommend you. And these families are not families that don't keep any tenets of Judaism and say, oh, we love this couple, they're nice people. We say, we have hosted this couple for Shabbos. We have shown them how to build a sukkah. We have shown them what a Pesach is and how to kosher a kitchen. We have loved to actually come to their house after they koshered their kitchen and eat there, etc., etc. We ask for letters of recommendation from a few people. So eventually, when they're ready, whether you go to this court or that court, again, I'm talking about the court I'm going to where you come polished, you have in your hand a letter of recommendation first and foremost from your community rabbi, whoever you decided, wherever you live. Two, we have Jewish life stories of the convert and the spouse. And three, letters of recommendation from the community members who are community members that are Jewish. And yes, in Israel, not only do they ask for letters of recommendation, but they say you need to have a family that adopts you, what we call a mishpacha ma'ametzet, because they actually adopt you. They look after you in the sense of teaching you about Judaism. And they come to the Beit Din, they testify in a very nice and beautiful way. We saw this couple here, and they're now way up here, and we saw the whole process. Again, outside of Israel, it's much more difficult to get to that situation because it's less regulated, but it's the same idea. Just you have letters of recommendation from people in the community. And if need be, and there's something quasi, we can contact those people and say, hey, first of all, did you write this letter or is it a fake or I? And number two is, well, let's hear more about what you wrote. You say they're wonderful. Let's hear how wonderful they are. Yeah, more questions.
If the person has a Jewish parent or grandparent, obviously that doesn't make them all Jewish, is that a very big factor because they want to return to the family? And if they come from a place like, you know, Burma, and they think they're living among Jews, and no one's like, maybe even halakhically Jewish, but they see Jews step around them and they want to join up with the Jewish people for reasons we think are interesting, which is very different from some traditional Jewish family, you know, in New York. Does that also play a role?
Okay. Regarding the first question, if they're what we call eligible for the law of return, namely they have a Jewish father, grandfather, they come from Jewish blood. It's actually called Zera Yisrael in halachic literature, not Zera Yehudi, same idea. Mainly, I always say they're part of the larger Jewish family, but albeit they're not Jewish. In other words, they're what we call half-Jewish or whatever you want to call it. In those cases, can you be more lenient? My answer, me, Yehoshua Grunstein, is no. You can't be more lenient in terms of the final
results. Requirements before.
And not in for the requirements before either. I tell you what you can be more lenient on. You can be more lenient on trying to encourage them to convert. In other words, a non-Jew in the street that says, hi, I don't need to be a missionary, and I don't think Judaism in any which way adopts missionaryism, even though I know there's a few rabbis that think otherwise. We believe that if you're Jewish, you have to keep the mitzvah. And if you're not Jewish, you can get to the same heaven or wherever Olam Haba is without keeping mitzvot except for seven mitzvot b'nei Noach. And that's what I believe. However, if you're a son of a Jew or a daughter of a Jewish father or grandfather, I believe that then we, the Jewish people, have an obligation to outreach to such people and try to encourage them to become observant Jews. And once we've succeeded, everything I said happens. You don't then say, okay, jump into the mikvah. Forget about everything we just said. Now, I know there's a school of thought out there that says that, but I don't believe it's correct. I don't believe with everything, all the sources they have, the only thing I'm willing, so to speak, to concede on is that to a non-Jew, total non-Jew, they want to convert, great, and if not, have a good life. With someone with Jewish blood, Zera Yisrael, I believe we have an obligation to outreach, to make them part of the Jewish community, and try to encourage a conversion. Once we've succeeded, everything I just said applies. There's no difference.
I mentioned because I've been meeting a lot of birthrighters through cousins.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of them have Jewish fathers. And
very,
they think
very good.
Actually,
and again, those are people that
think they're like half Jewish. Yeah.
See, birthright, I believe, is a very, very good example. In other words, get them to come to Israel. We'll pay for it, the country of Israel, that is, and ultimately try to outreach to them. But once you've succeeded, then everything I said applies. Mm-hmm. Yes, Mr. Weiser.
I want to think of a story. I know that he wanted to convert, and he kept chance. He was told, Nachash Shoshoas, Chavis. So, what did they do? He put on the light. He will keep Shabbos.
And just put on the lights. Yeah.
They told the light is not, and you know, because that's the reason. So, he strike a match. What do you say to this story?
Again, this is a machlokas in poskim. I have a saying that if you want to look wise, you have to quote the story and quote one line from the story. And everyone says, oh, you know it. The story goes as to the story in Yerushalayim. There was a story in Yerushalayim where a non-Jew was about to convert. This is the beginning of the 20th century, end of the 19th century. And they told him, some rabbi told him, you can't keep Shabbos, even though you're keeping Shabbos. You know, strike a match or rip a piece of toilet paper.
The light is not enough.
And light is not enough. You have to do malacha d'oraisa, so strike a match. And all the rabbanim in Yerushalayim went ballistic. And there's a famous tshuva of Rav Efflinger. Rav Efflinger was one of the last poskim in Germany. Rav Efflinger wrote, if you know the book Binyan Zion, that's his responsum. He wrote a book on Shulchan Aruch called Bikurei Yaakov. That was his first book, therefore he called it Bikurim, his first fruits. And he basically wrote of Yaakov Efflinger that this is a story in Yerushalayim, was a famous story, and he came to the conclusion that Dafka, the Rabbonim, that said, no, we're right. Namely, that if it's a convert, they should teach him to keep Judaism the way it is and not strike the match. But again, this is a machlokas in between Batei Din, between Rabbonim, to this very moment because of that Gemara, just with regard to Shabbos, every other mitzvah not. So just to reiterate, you go to a Beis Din either to open a file and they give you direction as to what's the next steps, how do you become an observant Jew, or the Beis Din's the last resort. In other words, the rabbi of the community is the one to outreach either to the couples that were Zera Yisrael, or not to outreach. Just sit in his office and a non-Jew knocks on the door and says, hey, I want to be Jewish. And they put him through the whole process and they become observant. And ultimately, when they become observant, they submit their paperwork to the Beit Din, which, as I said, in our Beit Din includes a recommendation from the community rabbi. Without that, we don't accept. And your Jewish life stories as to where you were and where you are.
You didn't come into like Burma, Africa. Do you?
And again, if you come from Burma or in Africa, again, I don't believe that, again, our Beit Din's policy is we do not convert people from communities that don't have Jewish communities. Even though I know there are people that do it, we don't believe that it's in the best interest of the convert to do it. And I'll explain very simply why. There's a famous conversion that's a little different than the one I've described here, and that is the little kids. Can you convert little kids? Let's say you adopted a child from wherever, and you're Jewish, and you want to adopt him and ultimately make him Jewish. So what do you tell? You tell the little kid who's 5 years old, do you accept mitzvot?
Yeah.
Let's say the kid is shy. He doesn't answer. Okay, we can't convert him. There's a whole different way of doing it. It's called a dat based in. Maybe the based in takes the responsibility saying, Zochin lo la'adam shelo befanav. You can do something good for someone even though they're not there. So I can give you a present. Let's say you deposit $5,000 in your account without you knowing about it. You don't need to give your acquiescence. It's in your best interest. Unless you have to pay taxes on it, it's no good. But in general, if it's in your best interest, it's fine. So, are we doing him a favor by making him Jewish? So there's two schools of thought. One school of thought says, you're making him a favor by making him Jewish, period. Even though he's going to live in a non-Jewish, and excuse me, in a non-observant home, they're going to eat oysters for breakfast, lobsters for lunch, they're going to violate Shabbos, Yom Kippur, and everything. It's still wonderful to be a Jew. And there is a school of thought that. The other school of thought, which is the school of thought that I am representing here, is that it's only a schut, namely it's only in his best interest if...
he wants it.
Not only he's a little kid. If he's living in an environment that would be conducive to living as observant Jews. So if he's living with observant parents, then it is in his best interest. And if they're not, then it's not. So I say the same thing with regard to an actual convert. I don't think it's in his best interest to convert and not live near a Jewish community. Imagine him keeping Shabbos and not talking to anyone about it because no one else is keeping Shabbos. Sitting in the sukkah on the first night of sukkahs, and then it rains and you have the whole halacha of what do you do when it rains on the first night of sukkahs, and the next day you can't tell anyone about that experience. So therefore we expect that you come from a Jewish community and that's where you're going to be on Shabbos and Yontifs, etc. And the idea also is, in the future, when you after you convert, you always want to be near a Jewish community. It's not just for the conversion, but rather later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I was involved once in a conversion, the old Kesher, and the Rav who did the conversion, as an aide, had the parents sign it. It was a firm couple,
yeah.
But that you have to send the kids to yeshiva, and you
yeah.
have to bring up them. So
yeah,
that
yeah.
was part of the process of the conversion.
Correct.
Is that they had to commit that they're going to bring up, it was an infant, but they had to commit.
So one of the things we ask for is exactly that. If you have a child converting, we ask that, are you going to live near a Jewish community? Are you sending your kids to Jewish day school, yes or no? And it's a lot of money in many, many countries, so we're talking about a very big commitment. And then, yes. And if not, then in general, we wouldn't accept. Yeah.
I've heard that like with kids, like, that at age 13 they can decide that they don't want to be Jewish. Like,
correct.
That's what I heard.
Correct. They can, but if they don't, what happens is they're Jewish, unless proven otherwise. At 13 they have the right to say, I don't like what my parents did, but if at 13, since they're living in a Jewish house for the last 5 years, 6 years, 7 years that they remember, since 5 years old, and they're 13 years old and they said Shema and they made a bracha, that's it. They can't now refuse. And in general, but they then don't say, okay, at 13, ask the kid. I know there's a school of thought out there that says, no, you have to ask him at 13. But in general, but they didn't do not. They say, listen, if he continues doing mitzvah, great. And if he didn't, then we never did a conversion, we made a big mistake, and that's it. But in general, most kids that are converted, and as I said, if they follow the protocol I just said, it's going to be natural that at 13 they're putting on tefillin and they're doing mitzvot.
You've characterized so far a very black and white situation, which is pretty clear. But you have a lot of middle ground. I mean, they're described as a solemn eshektik, kind of a background. They keep a lot of mitzvot. They do a lot. Anyone recognize them as Jews. They're not fully observed Orthodox style, but they keep asking for Shabbat, Kashrut, learning, big lovers of Israel. Any announcement would recognize them as Jewish. So politics aside, they're keeping lots of aspects.
What's the question? I don't understand.
Will those people be considered for conversion, or they're just because it's not...
I believe it's not black and white. First of all, it's never black and white. Every case is different. There's never such thing as black and white. That's number one. Number two, if what you're describing is correct, then what's missing? We expect, and again, I'm going to be very general here. We expect you to keep Shabbos and Yontif and the fast days. We expect you to know the laws of kosher food and how to keep kosher, but not just how to keep kosher. I'll explain in a minute how we do it. And, of course, the laws of family purity. And, of course, brachot before and after you eat. And the fundamentals of Jewish faith, those are the things we expect. If you're saying that this person is a Solomon Schechter student, they keep all of that, then what's missing? The one thing that's missing is they're not Jewish halachically.
No,
the Salva checkers don't keep that.
Yeah, the kid is.
I went to Salva
checkers. He knows about it. He's keeping aspects of it.
Right.
No. So yeah, we don't.
They say some brochot some of the time.
What you're describing to me is someone that's about 70% there, which is great.
Right.
And I would encourage them to get to 100%.
Well,
as soon as possible, not after the conversion, before the conversion, and then ultimately fill in what they're missing. And in this case that you're describing, it wouldn't take 2 years. It wouldn't even take 1 year. I believe 6 months would have been enough. They have to fill in a little bit about Shabbos. They have to fill in that, yes, they have to daven in a shul with a mechitza. They have to fill in that, yes, we daven that korbanos should come back. They have to fill in a few things, and then they're ready. And once they're ready, they're ready. And once they're ready, and this comes to our next stage. So you started a process, you're in the process, you keep, once you're ready, and I have my humble opinion, you don't put it off. Because the Gemara said, and we learned it all together, Mekablino Tomiyat. Once they're ready, and they accept it, acceptance means, I know it, and I do it, and I want to do it, why delay? Let's go. Now, it could take a few weeks till a Beit Din gets together, etc. Fine. As I said, if you're not Jewish, you're not Jewish. You can continue not to be Jewish. But once you're ready, you're ready. Now we get to the Beis Din. We get to the Beis Din. What does a Beis Din look like? So that, as we said earlier in our shiurim, we need to have three things today. There used to be four things. There was a korban. But now we don't have a korban, so we have three things. What's the first thing? What's ma'akev? Kabbalah's mitzvah. So, how do you do Kabbalah's mitzvah? If you say to someone, and I know there's schools of thought out there, say, you know what mitzvot are? Yeah. Do you accept? Yes. Good. Into the mikvah. That's very nice. Gentlemen, they know what Shabbos is. They know how to make a cup of tea on Shabbos. So when you say, do you accept mitzvot? The answer is, okay, what are mitzvot? So let's start from the beginning. First of all, why do you have to keep mitzvot? Oh, because God said so. Where is God? God is everywhere. Very good. Next.
Uncle Moshe
taught us. Next. The Torah. It's an old Torah. Can we change it? I mean, it's old. You can't change it. It's divine. Okay. So now let's talk about the Torah. You explained that God's the king of the world. You explained that you can't change the Torah. We got the Torah at Har Sinai, Torah Shebaal Peh, Torah Shebichtav, both, we believe. Great. So let's talk about the Torah, and let's talk about the basic bedrocks of a Jewish home. If I open up a Jewish home versus a non-Jewish home, what will I see inside? First, books. Nice. Nice. Important. No, important.
Candelabra.
Candelabra.
Shabbat.
We, in the conversion court, don't really care about the candelabra so much, or the books. We care more about what are you doing in your home. So you keep Shabbos, absolutely. Okay, so explain to us. How does your Friday look? Not how to make a cup of tea. You can learn that on Google. How does your Friday look like? I mean, Friday's a very tense day for a Jewish observant couple. Now, if they can't describe word for word, letter for letter, how their Friday looks like, then maybe they have the knowledge, but they're not keeping it. More than that, we say, you work for a living, or you're rich independently? Most people work for a living, normal people. Right? I never worked a day of my life, but normal people work. Now, if you ultimately say to them, hey, you work for a living, so what do you do on a Friday in the winter? If they can't say, well, I leave early, then we say a follow-up question. If you leave early, how do you make up the time? And they can't answer that correctly, you know that they're not authentic. And let's continue. How does your Shabbos look? Open us the door to your home and explain to us. How does your Friday night look? How does your Shabbos look? How does your Havdalah look? And then we ask certain questions within that. How do you make a cup of tea? Oh, we have an urn. We bought an urn 6 months ago. Not very nice. And how do you make a cup of tea on Shabbos? And how do you do this? And how do you eat, and what, and who, and where? And then, of course, we ask, Tess, here, you live 5 kilometers from the shul. Oh, we love walking 5 kilometers in both directions. Oh, yes, we love it. It's great for the calories on Shabbos. Sounds very beautiful. What happens when it's winter? No, we love the snow. We love walking in the snow. Yeah, there's an area in between the two places. No. So let's say you're walking, and as you know, when you're cold and you're walking, usually you need a tissue. What do? We suffer. You understand that by these questions, you're basically getting to, are you authentic or not? And we go into kashrus. Explain to us your kitchen. How does your kitchen look? How do you go shopping? So if a person says, I have an app, and this app tells me what's kosher, what's not, and I barcode and I see, and here's my app, and here's my phone, and this is how I do it, and it's very simple. We know, hey, they're doing it. They say, oh, keeping kosher is meat and milk and fins and scales. Okay, that we can read on the internet too. You can learn it before, the night before, you cram, and you tell the rabbis what they want to hear. But if you can't say, hey, this is the way I go shopping, and this is the stores I go to, and this is how my kitchen looks, and we obviously know you're not keeping it. Maybe you have the knowledge, but you're not keeping it, which is legitimate. Come back in a few months after you're keeping it. Laws of family purity. Do you know where your local mikveh is? Do you know how to prepare for the mikveh? Now, obviously, modesty is needed for this question, and we ask it in a modest way. Brachot, what's the bracha before you? What do you like to eat? What do you like to eat? Now, if any convert said, I only eat sandwiches, that's already a red light for me. Because everyone knows the bracha and bread is a motzi lechem min ha'aretz. They heard it in the synagogue. They heard it in the kiddushes. No, yeah.
They say I'm on a diet.
So here's where I think it's very important to say. When a beis din meets, if they're going to try to trick the convert, then it's wrong. If you're going to ask them, what's the bracha on pizza? That's not a very fair question. Just like it's not fair to ask a question like, what do you make on chocolate-covered raisins? Is the chocolate the ikar, or is it the raisins? What's the ikar, what's the tofu, what's the bracha? That's trying to trick a person. We have to ask a person, do you live a normative life? A normative life is a life of a frum Jew. A frum, simple Jew from the neighborhood. A frum, simple Jew from the neighborhood doesn't know necessarily what the bracha on pizza is. When he wants to know the bracha on pizza, he goes into the pizza store. Usually on the wall there's a little sign that says, I'm on the... That's what he does. What happens if my milchik spoon touched a very hot piece of flesh? Most Jews don't know the answer to that question. On the other hand, do most Jews understand when that happens you have to ask a rabbi? Or look it up? Yes. That's what we want the convert to get to. Be like most Jews who are observant. Not most Jews who are not observant. Don't be Barbra Streisand, just by example. Namely, most Jews that are observant. Okay. So we talked about Shabbos, Kashrus, family purity, brachot before. If a person's keeping the mitzvot, then they should know the brachas before. Brachas after, that's a gray area, because we believe you should know the brachot afterwards, albeit not necessarily in Hebrew. You can make it in English or any other vernacular you know, but you should tell us, well, how do you do it? What do you do at work when you eat a sandwich? Oh, they got a sitter. This is my sitter, and I have it with me, or this is my app, and then, oh, it's nice, you have an app. With the, they're at English, it's beautiful. What are you doing, Shabbos? That's not a trick question, that's a real question. Okay? And your co-workers, when they see you doing this, they don't think it's strange? Oh, they're very supportive. Here's a letter that they show how supportive they are. And you put on a kippah, what? You look strange. These are the questions we ask to see if a person's living a normative Jewish life. And we go on and on. And obviously we talk about yomtivs, and you take off for weekday yomtivs and fast days, and we ask them what the fast days are, and we ask them to go through the Jewish calendar and tell us about the Yom Tovim.
It's a long day.
What do you mean?
It sounds like with all these questions, like it's
normative based on the life I've been to takes about an hour and 15 minutes. If a person's living an observant life, this can be done in half an hour. So let's assume that because of translation between English or Spanish to Hebrew, it might take double the time, an hour. But we're not talking about rocket science. If you ask any kid on the street in Ephraim, what does it mean for you to keep a normative Jewish life?
And over time, you're going to learn all the details.
No. I'm explaining. Bruce, you're absolutely right that there's easy, a little hard, and over time, they'll learn more. Absolutely. But what's easy and what's hard? I believe that without what I just said to you, Shabbos, Kashrut, Taharat HaMishpacha, Brachot, Chagim, Tzomot, there's no Judaism. Once you add that, then we'll teach you about the laws of ribit, about taking interest on loans. Then we'll go on about the bracha on pizza. Then we'll go on. Yes, those are the details you learn afterwards. But the recognition that you have to make brachot, yes, I got it. The recognition is a Shabbos, yes. On Shabbos itself, can you open a can of tuna? That they'll learn afterwards.
But they tell you they love their Shabbat, they've been living with their family, they go every week to Shabbat to the synagogue, and they're learning about it, and they want to learn the whole Shabbat. You can tell that they're on the right direction. Then the fact that they know 10, 20, 30%, but they don't know the details yet, but they want to learn. Why isn't that good enough as opposed to, you know what, we're going to do the Shabbos test? That most Jews are going to fail, but we want you to pass this test.
No. I totally disagree. Most observant Jews will get the same test and pass just like the convert. And they will fail on the same questions as a convert. That's what I'm trying to say. These are not the trick questions of how can you open a can on Shabbos. These are the normative questions that a Jew... A normative house on Shabbos has a hot plate, an urn, a kiddush, a havdalah. That's what we want. The details, yeah, a lifetime of learning. I always say a certificate of conversion is a license to continue learning forever.
And Kibbutz on the had a, for the 10 or 15 going, we were interested, they ran a conversion program that dealt with the basic things they took. I don't know what order they took. But probably think, you know, like you mentioned, the fundamental pillars. And it, this took time. It was like once a week they came. And over a period of maybe a year or 18 months, they covered this. But isn't that the kind of thing that happens? Aren't there communities running conversion courses?
Yes, yes.
If not, it's under...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Either the rabbi, or it's private, or it's a conversion course for all the converts, and they have to learn a curriculum that I believe is what the one I just said. Now, every court can add in things. For example, there's one issue that I have to say is a very interesting gray area, and that's the issue of, do you need to know Hebrew? Now, it's no big secret. We can daven in English. Everyone knows that. Mm-hmm. We don't daven in English for various reasons, and I'm sure that in a normative synagogue, you'd sing the songs in Hebrew, but does a convert need to know Hebrew? Well, that's a gray area. That's a very big gray area, because I'll explain. Everything else I just said now, the convert's getting to the same level as you in terms of observance. When it comes to Hebrew, if you learned Hebrew as a kid, you remember it now, you're asking a convert at 40 to learn a new language. It's very difficult. So the question is, do we require that before the conversion? I don't believe it needs to be required, except for the areas that need to be said in Hebrew. For example, I believe brachot, before you eat, can be said in Hebrew. The kiddush can be said in Hebrew. Those are things you do every week. Mm-hmm. But when every day. Brachas are every day. Kiddush is once a week. But when it comes to davening, which is long, I think with time, they'll get to it. And yes, you can convert them if they don't know Hebrew. Other convert, no. If you don't know Hebrew, we can't convert you yet. Okay. Again, halacha does not require you to know Hebrew to be a good Jew. Halacha does require you to know what Shabbos is to be a good Jew.
Question for you. After the conversion is complete...
We didn't
right.
get there yet.
Well,
now let's go in order. Let's go in order.
Okay.
So now we're at the conversion court. We're asking these questions,
right.
And the three dayanim are satisfied. This person is living an observant Jewish life, and therefore they say, "We'd like to accept you to the Jewish people." I can't begin to describe in words that moment. We're talking about someone that went through, as said earlier, a year to 18 months to 2 years. This has been a long thing. Maybe one Beit Din they didn't like, and one rabbi didn't like them, and they didn't like him, and they got to it. They're here. And they made many changes in their life, including redoing their kitchen and koshering it. It's a beautiful moment.
And
but the Beit Din said, we'd like to accept
campus.
You into the Jewish community. And they get up, and at the Beit Din, and now we're getting into the actual halachos of conversion, because everything I just said now is the conversion process. I accept all the biblical commandments, the rabbinic commandments, and the good customs of the Jewish people. By the way, in our court, we do ask, do you know any rabbinic commandments or biblical commandments? You know the difference between them. It's not just out there.
What's the name of the Bible?
We'll get to that. Let's make a difference. And I believe in one God, because if you believe that God has helpers, then we're not accepting you to Judaism. That's another religion out there. They may accept you there. And then they say Shema Yisrael in Hebrew.
In Hebrew.
In Hebrew. And Baruch Shem, Kibod Mochotol, Olam Vaed. And it's a beautiful moment. I have videos of it on my phone. Sometimes when I need inspiration, I just look at it again. Because it's beautiful. We've never gone through that as Jews from birth. Where we had did a Nasiv and Nishma Mamish. And they did it. And now we go back to Har Sinai. Once we get to this situation, we're at Har Sinai. So Nasiv and Nishma they did. They accepted mitzvot in front of the Beit Din. Mazel Tov. Now, at that moment, halachically, I believe, and this is another shir, they have to keep the mitzvot, because they accepted mitzvot in front of a Beit, and now they have no choice. They have to keep mitzvot, they're not Jewish yet. It's very interesting. Mm. But that's a quasi-other shir. We have to give
so
it, we have
about,
proper
have
sources.
Their...
Right, exactly.
We spoke about
right?
that.
If they accept mitzvot, and then they die, where do you bury them? Now, now comes to the nitty-gritty. It's very simple, because again, everything I said now is the main thing. Everything else is very, very... as we say, protocol-based or procedural, namely. They have to do a brit milah if they're not circumcised. If they are circumcised medically, they have to do hatafat dam brit, which means you poke in that area. It's done usually a second before the mikvah if it's hatafat dam brit, because you poke, boom, mazel tov, into the mikvah. That's for a man. For a female, obviously, there's no hatafat dam brit or brit milah, just a mikvah. So the man goes into the mikveh, let's say, and he once again in the mikveh accepts all the biblical, rabbinic, and good customs of the Jewish people, and he believes in one God, and we tell him again that we tell him that there's sachar va'onish once you leave the mikveh, namely there's reward and punishment, and there's no going back, and you're ready to do this. And once he said yes, he dunks. And once he dunks, he makes the first bracha of his life where he can say, Asher kidishanu b'mitzvotah v'tzivanu, God, you have commanded me to go into the mikveh, and he dunks again. That's one of the only mitzvot that we make the bracha afterwards, because beforehand he can't make the bracha. Why not? Famous Gemara, he's not Jewish yet.
He makes the bracha of tefillah mikveh as a...
Al hatzvila, absolutely. Absolutely.
Men normally don't
That's
make
the
bracha.
Only time as a man he'll ever make that bracha.
Because
you're right.
Men don't
we have never made that right. bracha. I hope you've never made that bracha. There is one there, the Meban Erev Yom Kippur, you have to. It's brought in the Rosh, but no one paskins that way. We don't make that bracha. That's the convert's purview. He makes that bracha. A woman will make the bracha
else,
once a month, typically.
Someone else poke, or he does that himself?
No, someone else does it. Someone else doesn't. Three people look, that the blood comes out, finished.
Okay.
It's a very simple thing. It, and that's really no big deal. Now, moving on. No. Much less than a blood test. Much less. It's like if someone does an amalgam test and pokes you in your... That's what it's basically like. That's it. Now, for a female, this is the way we do it. For a female, you need to have three people in the room. As we paskin lachatchila, that's what you need to have. Three people at every stage. So three people for Kabbalah's mitzvot is ma'akev. Three people at the mila lachatchila you need. Or at the hatafat tambrit. And at the mikveh. For a male, fine. What do you do for a female? No three rabbis are going to look at a woman in her birthday suit, excuse me, for the same. So what do we do? Does anyone say a woman has to go into the mikveh with her birthday suit? The answer is no. A woman has to go into the mikveh not have a chatzitza. Namely, you're not allowed to have anything that will be any sort of a partition between you and the water. Same thing for a male. So what do? A woman wears a very long gown, which is loose enough that the water gets in, but long enough that it covers every part of her body. I'll even say that the gown is so long and covers so much that sometimes when a woman walks on the street, a good firm woman, she covers less than what she does in the mikveh. That's the way we do it. Then we come into the room and we ultimately ask the questions. She dunks into the mikveh. We don't, and obviously she dunks in once, again says the bracha, we say mazel tov, we leave the room. There are batei din that just because they're choshesh for various veils, they say, okay, we'll also do something else. Before we come into the room, let the woman dunk into the mikveh by herself. No one else is in the room, without the robe on. We'll be outside hearing the splashing of the water. Then she'll put on the robe, she'll go in. The robe is wet with water, it's not a chatzitza. The water can get in, it's not a chatzitza. And the men don't see any part of a woman's body that they're not allowed to see. And then the woman goes into the mikveh, based on the protocol I just said, Kabbalah's mitzvah, sachar va'onesh, etc. And now you're Jewish, lock, stock, and barrel.
Three women can't be the observers, it must be done.
Let's not get into that this morning. Okay? Let's not get into that this morning.
We said the politics.
Now, I want to give some factual information now. Okay, I know our time is up. I'll answer maybe afterwards because our time is low. I just want to give some factual information. This is the way it's done, and the person's Jewish in the eyes of halacha. Now, here's the bigger question. Is the person Jewish in the eyes of the wider Jewish community? Israel, London, Australia, United States, Canada. That's already politics. And I'm not going to talk about politics today because, in my humble opinion, politics is not something we talk about around this table. But I will say one thing about factual information you have to know about Israel. In Israel, we do have conversion courts. There are formal courts that are run by the Prime Minister's office called Batei Din Rabbanim LeGiur, and basically under the auspices of the Chief Rabbinate. There's only one little law that makes it a little impossible for non-Jews to convert. Remember you said before, Zera Yisrael?
Yeah.
Well, guess who could convert in Israel? In the formal courts of the state of Israel, the only people that can convert is people that have Jewish blood. Namely, their father's Jewish, their grandfather's Jewish, what we call eligible for the law of return. So if you are, excuse me for the saying, so a lily white non-Jew wasp, and you come to the Jewish state and you say, I want to be Jewish, and you go to the formal Beit Din And you are observant already. I don't know how you got there, but you got there. You have all the letters, etc. The state of Israel's formal courts have to say today, sorry, can't help you. Why? You're not Jewish. You're totally not Jewish. Yeah, I understand I'm totally not Jewish, but, you know, I want to be Jewish. Yeah, but you're totally not Jewish. We can't help you. But I want to convert. We can't convert you. Why? You're not eligible for the law of return.
That's a great friend.
Okay, one second. Now we have to say. So what do? Okay, I can't go to the formal courts. I go to a private court, whatever it might be. Same standards. Turns around the chief rabbin and says, we don't recognize private courts in the state of Israel. So what should a non-Jew do if they come to the state of Israel? The answer is? They can't convert in the state of Israel. Now, they could convert in the state of Israel. Namely, you can go to a private court and convert. And you'll be Jewish in the eyes of Hashem, in the eyes of the Jewish community, in the eyes of Halacha, not in the eyes of the state of Israel, the chief rabbinate of Israel, because of that law that says if you're not eligible for the law of return, you can't convert in the formal courts of the state of Israel. Let's go one step further. Let's assume it was a Jewish couple. So what should a Jewish couple now do once the lady or the man converted? So the mikveh's finished. Mazel tov. Welcome to the Jewish people. What's next?
Get married.
They have to get married Jewishly, even if they're married civilly prior, right? Here we got a problem. According to the laws of the state of Israel, you can't get married unless you register with a rabbinate. So if you go to register with a rabbinate, because you're a good citizen, the rabbinate says, we can't register you. Why? You went through a private court. Yeah, but I wanted to go through a regular court, but unfortunately I couldn't. Why?
Law of return.
I'm not eligible for the law of return. I'm totally observant. Totally observant. I can't. Sorry, can't register you. Now, according to the laws of the state of Israel, if you marry someone outside and not register them, it's a criminal defense. You can go to jail for 2 years, the rabbi and the couple. Now, what about this couple? Would they go to jail or not? That's an open question. Because I think the state of Israel would say, well, they're not really Jewish, so basically you never did a marriage. And there are legal briefs that say that. Others will say, no, we think you're Jewish, but we just can't register you, so we don't know what to do. So what do we tell these couples to do? It's a very nutty thing. If you're going back to your community, so get married, whatever. Get married there, whatever it is. But if you're not going back to your community, you want to make aliyah to the state of Israel, this is what you have to do. This is the craziest thing in the world. You can do one of two things. If you get married civilly outside of the state of Israel and you come to Israel civilly married to a Jew, then you can become a citizen. Once you're a citizen, you can go to the rabbinic courts. Okay, so we're encouraging civil marriage. That's one thing. Number two, we can do something else. They're living together. So first of all, let's get rid of the Aveira. So they're observant Jews. They get married privately, whatever it might be. Is it legal or not? I'm not sure. But let's assume it is. And they go to a private court. Fine. Now we tell them, go outside of Israel and get civilly married, then come back in, and then go to the rabbinic court, say, hi, I'd like to convert, quote unquote. And the conversion courts know how to deal with these cases. They ask you questions if you're ready. They put you sometimes in the mikveh again, sometimes not. They reauthorize, so to speak, the conversion you've already done. It's a nutty, nutty thing. That's just factual information. Has to your opinion on it, my opinion, that's not for now. Suffice it to say, I think it's unacceptable. Unacceptable. That the state of Israel, the state of the Jewish people, does not allow non-Jews to convert. I'm not talking about people that are Zerei Yisrael. I'm talking about real non-Jews. The state of Israel, the formalized courts of the state of Israel, does not allow non-Jews to convert in the state of the Jews. They can convert anywhere else, but not here. So it's a very interesting thing, and I'll just tell you the nafkamina. If you want to go back to some community in Chutz La'aretz, you have to ask one question. Does your community recognize the conversion of our private court? Yes, good. We'll convert you. That's fine. If you want to make aliyah, and I'm a very honest person, I have to give you real advice. Okay, you want to make aliyah, you're already living here, whatever it is, leave the country, go to some court in Chutz La'aretz, come back converted. Because in Israel, it won't happen. If you go to a private court, not recognized. So you have to, and you go to the formal courts, you're not Jewish. So where can you go? You can go to a court outside of Israel. Come back converted. So I think it's a crazy world. You're a Zionist. Again, if there's a convert in Efrat that comes from a Jewish father, grandfather, they can go through the formal courts. If, however, they're not from a Jewish father, grandfather, etc., then they do either one of the other. Either they convert outside of Israel and they come back converted, or they converted a private court, they leave Israel, they come back civilly married, they go through the process I just said. But I find it unacceptable. How can that be? How can it be in the year 2018, if you want to be Jewish and you want to ultimately go ahead and become an observant Jew, the state of Israel, the Jewish state, says you're not wanted. You're not wanted. We're not wanted. Now, they have various terutzim for it. We want to keep out the Sudanese. We want to keep out the conservative, the reform. I know all the excuses. I have a lot of solutions I can offer. But beyond the solutions, I think the actual factual information that if you're not eligible for the law of return, the state of Israel will not convert you is unacceptable. And it's equally unacceptable that if that law was in some way or another forced on the chief rabbinate, and they didn't want that law, then how can the chief rabbinate say, but we don't give you any other avenue? And we, at the same time where we have this law, wherever it came from, we also won't recognize private conversions. You know, either or. Either you accept everyone, which would be a wonderful situation in my humble opinion, close down every private court, one Jewish court for the state of Israel, and every run by the chief rabbinate, fine by me, or recognize private courts. Because what avenue are you giving to these people? And especially if they're married to a Jew, you're letting them live in sin. And who's encouraging them to live in sin? The state of Israel. The state of Israel. So again, if it's a total non-Jew, stomp comes, we don't have any really obligation to convert them. But you mentioned Zera Yisrael. They're married to a Jew. Don't we have an obligation to at least offer them, listen, stop living in sin, we have a good offer for you. Become an observant Jew and convert. Shouldn't we offer that? The state of Israel cannot offer that today. So I'm hoping that this will change, and I'll be the first person on record to say it has changed, Baruch Hashem, Atova Hameitiv, to the Jewish people. But so far, that's the situation. It's very sad. So we talked about how the actual life based in talk goes today, and at the end of the year, we talked about some of the factual information and how it plays out in Israel.